You're listening to another episode of the Secular Foxhole Podcast. Today we are happy to have a returning guest. Robert Begley is a director at the Objective Standard Institute. He co-hosts the Hero Show podcast and teaches a course called Your Super System for Success. He also writes articles and book reviews. Robert's a professional speaker who has spoken to audience acclaim, most recently in Nashville and Charlotte. Robert is a certified world-class speaking coach who helps TEDx speakers, businessmen, and entrepreneurs deliver more memorable messages. He danced ballet for many years, and a few weeks ago appeared as Claude Frollo in the story based on Victor Hugo's Notre Dame. That's pretty cool. Robert is also a global traveler, visiting all 50 states and dozens of countries, one of which is today's topic. Welcome, Robert.
Oh, thank you, Blair. It's very nice to be back here again with you and Martin. You guys have a great show.
Thank you. Thanks. We're going to talk about Greece, which is it's been on my bucket list, I don't know, for the last 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so why don't just go right into it, and we will savor every minute of it.
I can tell you, Blair, Greece was on my bucket list since I was a kid, learning about Greek mythology and then moving up to Greek philosophy. I read Plato when I was like in high school and then discovered Aristotle not long after that.
Good.
And always wanted to go there to visually see. As my bio says, I'm a world traveler. But one thing that stopped me was going with the right person. And it took me a long, long, long time to meet my dearest Carrie Ann, who is an ancient Greek scholar. So in 2015, when I asked her, "Do you want to go to Greece?" her jaw dropped. Darianne, she's a scholar, but her idea of going travel was conference, hotel, taxi, conference, hotel,
airport.
Taxi.
Yeah.
Yeah. Airport, taxi. Yeah. The works. And for me, it's like, no. I have to walk where Aristotle walked. And so once she got excited, she went into research mode and found the Lyceum had just been opened up, the one that Aristotle himself walked in. So we made a list of all these places to go to, not exclusively Aristotle, but he was the main focus. So the pilgrimage was, let's go to where Aristotle was born, in ancient Stagira, where he flourished, in Athens, and then where he met his end in Chalcis, all in Greece, and or what the northern part is was Macedonia, Stagira. But so we made those plans and set it up in 2015, the height of the financial crisis in Greece.
Oh boy!
But we were excited with the idea. Our families were scared to death because, you know, communication can break down when you're in, I can't call Greece a third world country, but it's like 2.5 maybe.
Well, yeah, they lag behind.
You're so good at drawing the parallels, and now they are on that list. You could wonder which direction USA is also. And other parts of the world, but they have the history, Greece. So if I with this listen to this episode with your spirit, I bet they could, move up to.
I wish they did, and that's kind of how I conclude a summary that I wrote about our visit, which is one of the saddest things. I don't have to go through like chronologically what we did and where we went, but whenever we would bring up Aristotle's name, there was like a blank stare. And I would tell in Stagira, for example, we went to the place where he was born, and in the restaurant, which was just opening, they didn't even have food. We needed to wait like an hour to be served. But the woman could sense my New York accent. So when she asked where I was from, I was like, New York. And she has this big smile. And then she asks, what are we doing here? And I point to the statue of Aristotle. I'm like, we are here for him. And silence, like a blank face that had no idea that she lived or she worked in the place where Aristotle was born. And that disconnect, Blair and Martin, was so sad to experience because we know that, Western civilization was born in Greece. You know, the first, so many firsts of it. And that's where humans were turned, you know, effectively from pygmies to giants for this couple of century time frame. And so that disconnect is, it's real. And as you said, Martin, sadly, the United States and Europe as well are, seems like they're moving farther and farther away from the ideas of Aristotle. And what ideas are those? That man has a nature and he can be heroic. His mind is what distinguishes him. Aristotle calls us the rational animal, and his own happiness is his highest purpose, that ideal, which he calls in English, it's flourishing. In Greek, it's eudaimonia. Mm-hmm. And that's it. That's what we should do. We should strive for that as our purpose in life. And so knowing this man lived there was just such a big draw for us. And we felt his presence, I can say without a doubt, walking in this Lyceum. So again, it was push and pull. It was like, man, this is great, but nobody knows it. We went to the Lyceum twice, and there was only one other person both times. And we only realized that it was the same person who was worked on the premises. When we went the second time, we saw that it was the same person, and she was on her working her out, you know, work hours. That was her job. So wasn't this place filled with hundreds of people? Students have this great luxury of being in a place where such greatness was a daily occurrence. You know, the three of us know the greatness, but sadly, it's not as widely understood these days as it should be.
That disconnect still affects us today, perhaps.
Yes, I totally agree. And since one of you two hosts has Lyceum in their email name, I'm wondering why, Martin? What does it mean to you?
Yeah, for me, it was we had a philosophic magazine called Lyceum.
Yes.
So we translated Rand's works and others and publication that we got permission from. And we attended a big book fair in Gothenburg, and we promoted her ideas, Rand's ideas. But we wanted to, we were not an official publication. So Jerry Nilsson, he came up to, why not call it Lyceum? And then we talked about how it should be Lyceum, and I'm not, as your partner, know the Greek language and stories and so on, so Lyceum or something like that, but Lyceum, it has a ring to it.
Yes.
And then later on, I used it for my Gmail account and also my Twitter account that is now Lyceum Peripatus. I gave away Lyceum to Lyceum.fm to Zachary Davis, that is in New England, and it has an audio format, like a podcasting for academia and so on. And he connected and reached out to me on LinkedIn. And so then I added Peripatus to Lyceum. So
yeah.
It had been dear for me for a long time, but I want to walk around.
Yes.
There also. So it's on my
That's the peripatetic.
And I could say that for a record. I want to have you as a guide now and your partner. So let me figure out that for some time.
Sure. Just one thing I'll piggyback on so in a healthier culture, your Gmail is your email is lyceum@gmail.com.
Yep.
In a healthier culture, you would have to fight for that. Yep. ID. You type in Lyceum and they give you Lyceum 9851@gmail.com. Yep. Mm. Right? If they, it should be
in
that
a healthier culture, yeah.
Yeah.
That was early.
Okay, so
go ahead.
I was just going to continue, but I feel free to, you know, jump in with questions. So if you had something else there, Blair.
Well, I just, if you think of Greek history, Thermopylae.
Yes.
And then you mentioned the mythology,
yes.
Mount Olympus and Prometheus and those great characters and events. I mean, the circumstance didn't happen at Thermopylae, we probably wouldn't be here. Maybe not.
Maybe not. And that is, for those who don't know, the film 300 captures like the battle side of it, not as much the ideas. But yes, Oh boy, what were the opponents from across the
Persians, weren't they?
The Persians, yes, thank you. I drew a blank there. So the Persians, basically all cultures were warring cultures dating back to day one in human history. And the Persians came into Greece to take over, and there were 300 men led by King Leonidas in Thermopylae, which is a strategic spot in Greece. And they held them off until the other Greeks came and saved the culture from destruction, from takeover by the Persians, who had a completely much more mystical culture, not this worldly, the way the Greeks were. And so that when we went there, when we stood in front of that, there's a statue there of King Leonidas. And if you know the film, 300 basically, he kicks early in the movie. He kicks somebody into this pit. There's like a circular pit, and that's where the bad guys, they just throw them in there. It's probably like 30 feet deep, a circle, and it's 30 feet deep, and they, never again will they come out. Yeah. Well. And so I did that pose while I stood there, and then 15 other tourists came after us, and they're all standing there doing the pose as well. So
that's pretty fun.
It was. But so Thermopylae is pivotal. Similarly, Marathon was another spot, different battle, different Greeks saved their culture against the onslaught of foreigners. And that's where we get the marathons from. You know, they can't remember now the one who went there and basically ran 26.2 miles to say, you know, to give news. And then he promptly killed over and died. But the point here is landmark locations in Greek history are spots that preserved this pro-reason. Actually, let me clarify. It's more pro-reason than what came before it and for many centuries after it. Yeah. But I do want to clarify that the Greeks were not as pro-reason as we might think. I mean, here's an example. Leonard Peikoff says, you know, ancient Greece is my favorite culture, and I somewhat wished I lived there. I'm happy to be alive today, frankly, because if you think they were, even at the golden age of Greece, they were still warring groups, city-states, and they killed Socrates. And they forced Aristotle to leave, to run for his life. So I wouldn't really want to live in a place where my best thinkers, two of the three greatest thinkers from the ancient world, either were killed or were threatened to be killed. I'd like indoor plumbing. Okay.
Exactly. I also like breathing.
I like breathing. Yeah. And I like more freedom. So there were a lot of things. Absolutely. Ancient Greece was incredibly rational and incredibly secular to some extent, but the mythology, you know, they used to pray to Apollo before big battles. And if you didn't pray to Apollo, then you were at the mercy of, you know, some of the leaders. So that's where I don't want to sugarcoat it. I don't want to paint it as only this pure rational, this Atlantis in Atlas Shrugged. It was not, but it was a starting point. It was a starting point that so much of what we have today, so much of the best of what we have today originated.
True. And I was going through your essay. Mm-hmm. I can't help but bring up certainly one of my top five favorite rock bands, Rush. Yes. And, you know, some of their lyrics. Can you go delve into
the Oracle? Yes. The Oracle at Delphi. So we go to Olympus, Mount Olympus. I mean, who doesn't know Mount Olympus? And you're in Greece. If you have a chance, you have to go, right? And you have to see what it was like. What did these writers, what were they, what kind of picture were they painting with this place where Zeus is known to throw thunderbolts from the top of this mountain? And so many stories took place there. So Karen and I drove to the top, and it was white knuckle driving because there's no guardrails and you're 1,000 feet above. If you lose attention for 3 seconds, you could easily tip over. And but you could see the I think it's the Aegean. You could see the water, the clear blue water in the distance as you're going up. And I'm getting goosebumps. We both are, you know, knowing this is the place we've read so much about. And so, yeah, Rush, they have their Hemispheres album, probably my favorite album. They have two characters, Apollo, who is the god of reason, and Dionysus, who's the god of love. So it's this reason versus feelings conflict. And from Olympus is where bringer of balance, Cygnus, that's where he makes like a pivotal move, and he wants the two to be together as one single integrated unit. And so when I was there, Blair, it was like, yeah, I'm in a Rush epic album, you know, like that's where I am. That's kind of what I felt there. So thank you for reminding me of that.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome. In your notes to me, you also mentioned that there could be some mistranslations of ancient Greek.
Yes. So this is where Carrie Ann is better. And I promise she will be on your show at some point when she has less than a million things to do. But there are two terms I just want to touch briefly on that leads to, in my opinion, where a lot of that Richard McKeon, they always recommend, you know, objectivist scholars recommend the McKeon translation. And one word is called nous. In Greek, it's nous, which Aristotle translates that as intellect. Okay. But because a lot of the translators are moral intuitionists, they call that word intuition. Mm-hmm. Now, what do you think is the difference between intellect and intuition?
Yeah, I've always heard that as it meant reason. So, you know.
Reason can certainly be one
in translation or one interpretation.
Yeah, one translation, yes.
One interpretation, yeah, okay.
Yeah, I'm not sure directly. I don't have to see. Here's where Carrie Ann would just tell you right off the top of her head. But that's a big one. And then the second one is ousia, O-U-S-I-A, which is often translated as substance, particularly Thomas Aquinas. He called it substance in Latin, substantia. And really in ancient Greek, what Aristotle called it was being, B-E-I-N-G.
Wow.
Now, if you're going to start your philosophy, okay, if you have a primary starting place, which one do you think is more fundamental, being or substance?
Well, you have to be before you can understand substance, maybe.
Yeah, substance is the derivative of being, right? Exactly. And I think that's part of the problem with a mistranslation here, because it's not a fundamental, it's not as fundamental. It is an attribute, right? It's actually an attribute. Yeah. And in Aristotle's categories, he talks about these different attributes of categories, all based on the being, on different forms of being, weight, height. It's, you know, the way Ayn Rand goes through her epistemology, that's what Aristotle does in his categories. So knowing this difference, I often tell Carrie Ann that I say, you should write like a paper that says, you know, we're going to fix Thomas Aquinas's substance abuse. We're going to fix that.
Okay.
Because and that's why I have to admit, she's not as big on Aquinas as most objectivists are. You know, we think even Ayn Rand herself said the big three are Aristotle, Ayn Rand, and Aquinas. I love how she says that in one of the Q&As of philosophy of objectivism, Leonard Peikoff's course.
But I always say two and a half because he got half of it right.
Yeah, exactly. And it's fabulous to reintroduce Aristotle to Western, you know, Western culture. But because afterwards, the succeeding centuries, they lumped him in with religion. And that is not, you know, if that's the only way to get him in, I could understand that as a transition for a short period of time. But when we reach the Renaissance and Galileo and all these great scientists, and they're somewhat denying the importance of Aristotle, then I think that's where I say there's something is wrong here. I mean, he was not right about everything. I mean, he didn't have the data. He didn't have the units to tell so many things that were later proven. But he gave us the principles. Okay, he gave us the scientific method did not exist before Aristotle. And so we want to get as much right of his ideas as we can. And that's where I can't blame Ayn Rand. I can't blame Leonard Peikoff. They're not Greek scholars who go with a fine-tooth comb over each particular point, especially when there are real critical terms to get right. So those are two translations that I think if objectivists had those right, there'd be a lot more admiration for Aristotle than there is today. And the other thing is, in going through his works, one of these mistranslations also leads to thinking that he is what's called a moderate realist. And that's, you know, we're in year six of going through his entire corpus, a small reading group of reading all of Aristotle with objectivists and trying to poke holes in him. But we're not seeing moderate realism in there. So those are some things that I want to defend. And if I could, I can't speak for Ayn Rand, but I think she would be elated to know that she was closer, the two of them were closer than she ever knew they were.
Mm-hmm. I know that she, in her epistemology work, she did say that, you know, Aristotle, and I can't remember the exact words, but he considered something this way, but it's, and but she says it's this way. You know, so that's...
Well, there are a few things, like essence.
Yes.
I think
it might be one of them. Yeah,
that's essence is one of them. For. Essence is in the thing. Aristotle, the way Peikoff says it, Aristotle considered it metaphysical, and objectivists call essence epistemological. And yeah, I don't agree with that. I think Aristotle and Rand are exactly the same there. But for clarity's sake, Blair, this is where I defer to my sweetheart Carrie Ann and say, put your questions into a bin, the both of you, and even ask others. And then we just go to town, you know, for clarity's sake. But if I could just repeat my point about Rand, we know how much of a hero worshiper she was.
Yes,
and we know how much she admired Aristotle. And I don't think she, you know, if she saw him as even a greater giant, I think that would bring her more joy in life. You know that. But can you imagine what this man did? And yes, I came up with a parallel track on my own. So we're not denying Rand's achievements at all. But we're saying that somebody else, you know, 2,500 years ago came up with these discoveries. But they've been, you know, sadly, they have been bastardized. So we don't get the real McCoy there.
Hopefully someday that'll be straightened out. I know that I am, you know, listening to other objective scholars, and they did a seminar on this. There is an Aristotelian revival in some of the universities anyway here in America.
Yes.
And that's always a good thing.
Yes, it is. I totally agree. And so the more of him, the more of Aristotle, the better. I mean, his ideas are time tested in the sense that we know things have a nature, you know, as his metaphor says, we know that we have a means of understanding things, as his epistemology says. And then similarly in his ethics, that humans have a nature. And it is, so, in my talk last week in Charlotte, I talked about how self-love was so important to Aristotle. This idea of self-love, what we can call selfishness or self-esteem, that was essential to, if you're on your way to eudaimonia, this highest act of flourishing, self-love is essential to it. And also, if, you know, that's a big part of friendship, where you are set up, and self-love is guided by reason. And that's another point that he makes in his that's all in his Nicomachean Ethics, which I just think is a fabulous work. But we don't hear that term, you know, self-love, we don't hear that used in as positively. We think of the narcissist or the egotist, and not the egoist. But Aristotle means the egoist in the proper sense there.
Sure. And Martin mentioned this too. And when he mentioned it, I recall watching, I forget if it was PBS or if it was some sort of British.
Yes,
BBC.
No, it's called Aristotle's Lagoon. That was a great documentary.
Highly recommend. Yeah. I have one single favorite scene in that, but I'm curious what you guys thought. What did anything jump out at you aside from just the idea that Aristotle has the chance you know, the Plato's Academy, he's been there for 20 years. Plato dies. Aristotle is the next logical guy, but they give it to Plato's nephew instead. And I was like, Aristotle's like, I'm out of here. You know, I'm just going to go to nature. Right? Yep. Goes to the Isle of Lesbos. I'm just setting up the context, which the host does beautifully, I think, in that show.
I'll be honest. It's been several years and I...
Okay, no. How about you?
It's same here because I watched it when it was, you know, airing, and then it's hard to get it. But as you said, set up it in a nice way. He felt that okay, now I'm going to this island and studying nature, and the sketches and how he studied all the animals, and then we have it again. I mean, that maybe he didn't get everything right, and due to that fact, he got all these works put in the basement, so to speak.
Yeah.
But when I saw that the beautiful nature and how he explained it, again, I said, I want, but right now, I mean, it's a mess there. But someday in the future, I want also to see the beautiful nature. I want to see if the, you know, the works is are they available there or where are they? And what could you learn from that? And how he did it. So, I mean, another topic, I mean, on biology then is...
Yes. First biologist, right?
Yeah. So, he's that was something that... Oh, not only a philosopher, it's that too. Yes. So it's like a Leonardo da Vinci... type personality. And then I said, wow, I mean, I really, and that's my question because it's not my expertise or not my field, but if you or your partner has any recommendation for a layman how to study, but that documentary made me, okay, I want to go there too.
Yeah.
So that was standing out, the production of a documentary. And both it was modern, but it also was going back in history. So I could really... feeling going back to the history.
Yes.
So that was my...
So just for your audience to get a little wider context, I watch, you could just do a YouTube search for Aristotle's Lagoon and you'll find it. It's free. It's about 1 hour long. So he shows about one of the things, how do you gain knowledge? You observe data. And Aristotle would vivisect. He would slice open live...
I'm a bit sensitive there, so.
Okay, I can understand, but I hope you don't mind this one.
I joke with it because that's the right way to do it. That's the right way to do it.
That's the way to do it. That's the way you have to do it. And you take data, and why does this reflect, you know, if the thing is dead, why is one leg still moving, for instance?
So all of his sketches, when I saw them, I was like, this is like Da Vinci. This is his...
He was Da Vinci before Da Vinci. Yeah, exactly. But so my favorite line in the entire episode is the host. He's talking about this, that Aristotle would do, you know, he'd slice open these reptiles, these animals, etc. And he would take out the heart of a living turtle. And you say to yourself, what is, ouch, you know, I would never do that. But then he says, what was Aristotle looking for? He was looking for its soul. And when I hear that, I'm like, oh man, that's great. Because he shows, he gives a little bit of a backstory of the difference. What is the soul and what is the physical? Because living beings are composed of those two, as you know, animals and humans. The higher beings have the two. They have the soul. And actually, for clarity's sake, let me just stay with humans as far as the soul and the body. And so Aristotle, in his inquisitiveness, curiosity, he's looking, he knows that living things have souls, and he's looking for it by cutting open a turtle and trying to take out its heart and seeing if his soul is in there. And of course, you know, the turtle dies and that's that. And the soul doesn't fly up into heaven, you know, the way some think. But to me, that was such a poignant scene in the documentary that I and the way the author describes it. I said, yeah, you get insight into the nature of Aristotle's curiosity. So I will, just to transition here back to our trip, the one place that we felt closest to Aristotle's lagoon was where he was born, in Stagira, which is right on the water. It's today somewhat like a beach town. Mm-hmm. But then if you walk, there's a bend that you walk around.
Is it accessible? Easy to get there?
Yes. Yes. Wow. Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's lots of, what we're saying, we should look at the positive, but it's lots of guiding tours there or lots of people
nobody knows.
Touching
nobody,
the ground, so nobody, to speak.
Exactly.
I mean, did he even mark his birthplace at all? Or?
Well, again, this is where there was a statue, a white, like half-length statue of him. And the woman who worked in the restaurant didn't even know really who he was. It's just somebody out there. So there are there are signs that say Stagira, ancient Stagira, but you don't really see Aristoteles is in Greek. You don't see that name plastered anywhere where this is the birthplace of Aristotle. So that, I think, is sadly an unjust preservation of their history, of Greek history. And if we go back to the disconnect that we are living in. So you need to know why you're there specifically for that purpose. But what I saw was, because it's on the beach, I saw all the different flora and fauna and how Aristotle, as a 12, 13, 14-year-old, would start categorizing. Well, these things over here are different colors and they have different substances and different aspects than these ones over here. And these things coming out of the water have that. So what Carrie Ann and I did is we just kind of put ourselves in his place as a teenager and could see this inquisitive boy starting to make these different categories and separating, what do we say in objectivism? Differentiating and integrating. All right. They're different kinds of species, but they have these similar aspects as well. So that was the feeling we had while we were there. And then there was this little walkway that we didn't know when we were there. But afterwards, about a year later, there was some program where they said, this is possibly where Aristotle was buried, because although he died in Chalcis, there's no grave or anything that we can specifically go to. That wasn't what the Greeks really did back then. So then when we heard it's possible that Aristotle, they put him back in the place where he was born, again, the goosebumps came, and I'm getting them now, that we could have been in the place both where he's born and where he's buried. And that's a powerful feeling.
And now also, as I said, that open up where he studied, lectured, and had this school, Lyceum. That's also great. That it's now open, and they have found it, and not bury it. And
that's
also,
right.
As I said, doing this creative, productive thing, and turning this, in a way, you could say, defeat, that he should have had that position, and then instead going out and going to Ireland and starting doing these sketches and categorizing and doing this work. That's fascinating.
Yeah, and if we follow that up chronologically, Martin, he was away for like 12, 13 years. And the two main things he did during that time outside of Athens, because again, he was a foreigner. Hmm. He was a foreigner in Athens and treated as such. And so he wasn't so you can't be a citizen if you're a foreigner, for example. You can't vote. You have definite limitations on what you can do. And so he goes to the island of Lesbos, which is Aristotle's lagoon. And then the king, Philip of Macedonia, wants Aristotle to tutor his son, Alexander. Right. So those are two like prominent things that he did before he returned to Athens to open up his Lyceum.
Yeah, I remember when I read that they had discovered it, it was just a feeling of elation.
Mm-hmm.
Personally.
Yeah. And who knows, Blair, I'm sorry, can hold that thought. Imagine if they find all his works too, like somewhere, like we only have a quarter, 25% maximum of his works. Imagine if they find the other 75% while doing this, the culture would be ours in like 2 weeks, right?
One would hope.
Yes, I am overly optimistic there.
I wonder if they're buried in the Vatican or something.
it could be the name of the Rose. Yeah.
Yes, the name of the importance road.
Have you seen, of course, it's, and it, as I said, Blair asked about the Aristotelian studies. Have you seen any coming there now in Greece or interested in his life and his work?
No, we were surprised. We did reach out to one person. We did like a search back in 2015. I think there was some correlation, some Greek person who now I can't remember his name, that was doing some kind of studies in local, you know, locally, but we hit a dead end. So that might be happening. I'd love to know that that's happening. So that's actually a good project. That's a good research project to see.
It could be because, you know, we would not mention these other philosophers on the show, but you could go to other places in Europe. Say no more. And there they have statues and they have all kind of scholars. And that's why we are in that situation that we are nowadays. But again, the positive thing is that they open it up and you have done this journey. It's so astonishing you have done that and documented in this post. And I think you, if you have time, energy, and see the value of it to do something more about this, this is great.
You're right. Thank you for that, Martin. And we do want to follow up. I mean, Carrie Ann gives talks. So, for instance, she gave a fabulous talk also in Charlotte on Aristotle, Ayn Rand, and friendship. Mm-hmm. And just one brief point here is that two out of the 10 books of his ethics, what we would call chapters, he calls books, two out of the 10 are dedicated to the topic of friendship. And aside from Ayn Rand's novels, in her novels, she gives clear dramatization of what friendships are.
Sure.
But she doesn't talk about them in her nonfiction. She doesn't really define friendship and give like it's more dramatized than explained. But Aristotle was the reverse. I mean, he might have dramatized it in his dialogues, which Cicero called liquid gold, and they're sadly lost. But in his ethics, friendship is like so important. And it would be that's a good study in following up on who might know other things about him that we don't know. So I think that's definitely something worth pursuing.
Great. True. Robert, I want to ask you one more thing, if I may.
Sure. I have one. Just there's one other Greek mythology.
Please go ahead.
Something that I want. Oh, if you want to hold your thing as like a last.
Yes.
So we're in there. We're in Greece for like 6-7 days, and we went to Delphi, where this massive statue of Apollo, and we did Olympus, and we see some references to different, you know, Athena, which is who Athens is named after, like older statues of these heroes that we know dating to antiquity. So after like 5-6 days, I tell Carrie Ann, I'm like, you know, the one Greek mythological hero I haven't heard or seen anything is Prometheus. So I do a Google search, and it turns out that there's a building that has the four walls of it. There's like a fresco of the story of Prometheus. And in fact, it's right next door to what is now called the Academy. There are two parallel buildings, and the Academy has two incredible statues of Plato and Socrates, like seated on opposite sides, the way you enter into the Academy. Now, it's not the same Academy that Plato founded,
True, but
it's clearly a tribute to it. So the next building over, I think it was a school or something. It was just not really open to the public. It wasn't, you wouldn't go there unless you had a purpose. So sure enough, in my research, I'm like, wow, this building that we walk by every day has like something about Prometheus. So we go in, and the tour guide, the guide is, he was ecstatic because we knew so much about about Prometheus, and he gets to tell us the real legend. Because what do we know from Howard Roark's speech? You know, Prometheus was chained to a rock and torn by vultures because he brought knowledge to men, and he wanted, you know, fire.
Yes, did you find the fire?
Yes, he brought fire to men. So the tour guide tells me the longer story that Prometheus created humans out of clay. And he just goes in detail. And we're seeing some elements of that in the artwork. Hmm. So he's happy. We're happy because we're getting more of a story about Prometheus. And then at the end, I ask him, I say, what kind of bird was it? Because Ran, I didn't say I'm Ran, but she always calls it vultures. And I've also read that they were eagles that pecked at him while he was chained to a rock. And we know there's a fundamental difference between a vulture and an eagle,
certainly,
right? So the guide said, no, it's the noblest bird. The noblest bird is the eagle. Okay, even America has that, you know, even, yes, even our founding made that connection, which don't know if it had Greek roots or not. So now I'm thinking to myself, well, why did Rand change it? And I don't know. It's just speculation. But I would think that because it's a noblest bird, it's less heroic. In other words, if you had something, a vulture comes when you're dead. It's more of a negative there.
Yeah, sure.
The pain and the connotation there and the evil of what they did to Prometheus, punishing him for this creation, is that you get the thing that will come at you when you're dead, which is the vulture. So that was like a little side discovery that we had. And we thought, man, this is it's fabulous to hear from a local. And one sad thing, I'll finish here, okay, Blair, and with and Martin, is the young people. We only met a few young people, and we didn't see that curiosity. We didn't see – this tour guide was nice in that he, you know, he had some specific knowledge there. But there wasn't this feeling that I want to learn everything, you know, and I have this great ambition because I'm young and the whole world is in front of me. It was just more of a duty type of aspect of living, you know, like, and that troubled me as well. That going back to the disconnect, because there was so much greatness surrounding them, and it was just wasted. And so that was a bit of a downer. But this one tour guide, we made his day, and he made our day.
That's great.
I bet, Robert, with your enthusiasm and so on, as you have, what you have done in New York, with going around with,
yes, Rand, tour guiding could, for people, yeah, yes,
you could do the same thing there. So yes, we'll look forward to that in the future.
yeah, that's true. Yeah, but that's a good point. He was proud, the way I would be proud to show New York, especially inside parts that people didn't know about. New Yorkers would know, oh, you got to come here and look at this from this side. The view is fabulous.
So, yeah. So in a way, that's good that you have to, you know, investigate yourself. It's not, I mean, it's nice to be tourist and be served in that way, but to really to get these details and get the behind story and really sense it. So, so that's the thing. I mean, that could be something to look forward in the future. So thanks again, Robert, for this fascinating journey.
Sure. And I think one thing, Martin, if I could somewhat summarize last point, curiosity matters. Okay. Like that's what this trip was, a curiosity in the sense that we went there to discover things we'd never had firsthand, you know, experience with. And even seeing Aristotle's birthplace, death place, and flourishing place wasn't enough for us, because I'm going back to my 12, 13 year old person who loves Greek mythology, and I'm in this land for 6-7 days, and I'm like, well, but what about Prometheus? I saw Apollo, I saw Achilles, I saw this one, that one. So yeah, it was the curiosity at the end that helped us. And the more we have, the more anybody has of curiosity, I think that gives you a good future. You're young in nature when you're curious.
Have it been any like plays of about Aristotle and his life and journey, or?
No, sadly, no plays. We did see a play in the Lyceum. They had an evening performance of Aeschylus. And what they did was we heard there were going to be references to Aristotle. And what they did is they projected, it was kind of like a war, it was somewhat of a dark play in Greek, but they projected subtitles onto a building. So it was at night, so you could see the subtitles. And what they did was they took a few quotes from some of Aristotle's works, but it wasn't this magnificent experience that we kind of hoped it would be. And if you, in modern culture, I think the only time that Aristotle, and they get him wrong, is the film Alexander with, I can't remember the main character who played him. It came out around 2004, 2005.
I'm going to just throw out Colin Firth, maybe? I don't remember.
Yes, not Firth. He's the Brit. This is another Colin, but you're right. That's the first name. But the older Christopher Plummer is the one who plays Aristotle, because they do flashbacks when Aristotle is teaching Alexander. And Christopher Plummer is like 60 years older than Alexander. So like, in other words, they portray Aristotle as this old thinker who's weak, you know, physically weak. And that, so they get him wrong there, even like their physical portrayal of him. And no, he was a young, vibrant person to his, talk about youth and curiosity is what kind of keeps you younger. So that was one thing, you know, one popular film portrayal of Aristotle that I was disappointed in. But I don't know, clearly he's worthy of a streaming video 10-part series.
Okay.
talk about wishful thinking and healthier cultures, but right now, not enough.
And again, you know, how the transport through the history, like the Aristotle Adventure, is it?
Yes,
Fergus Long.
That's right. That's right.
That will be needed in, again, this time and age.
Yeah, I could say one last thing, actually. Yes. A future talk that I'm planning is somewhat biographical and historical with a parallel. So three of my top heroes in history are Aristotle, Ayn Rand, and Alexander Hamilton. Here are some similarities between all three of them. They were born in one place, they became immigrant, they immigrated to another place, and they made an impact, and then after they were gone, their achievements were misrepresented or mistranslated. So now we get a watered-down version of the giants that they were. So Aristotle, we said, born in Macedonia, goes to Athens and then has to run for his life. And we have mistranslations of him. Rand, we've lived through that. We've seen, you know, born in Russia, comes here, and so much is misrepresented about her. It's not a matter of translation. It's a matter of misrepresenting, because in 100 years, you know, they will show that she did, in fact, eat babies. Right. if things sadly continue and distort,
that ends our discussion today.
and in Hamilton's case, he was born in the Caribbean, comes to America, and as a foreigner, was definitely treated differently. The quibble about his personality, and that he was certainly vocal in his views and very in your face type of person, but I think similarly there was. Because he died young and his opponents outlived him and some to a high degree retold his story. So we don't have Hamilton, just like Rand and to some extent Aristotle. When you talk about them, you have to stand on your head and give a 15-minute monologue saying, no, this is what they actually wrote. This is what they actually did and meant, before somebody would even not have these 50 different interpretations or of what each of these three people actually did. So that's a project of mine for down the road.
Great.
Those premises.
Great.
Thank you.
All right. You've talked about it throughout, but I want to ask you one more time, Robert, to when you and Carrie Ann went to the Lyceum and you were by yourselves, can you just, with as much clarity and an honesty as you can, describe your feeling when you stood there at the Lyceum?
Yeah. Thanks for asking, Blair. I actually brought this up in my talk on Sunday. I had two images. My talk was on the relationship between self-development and selfishness and how the two overlap. And the way I started is, your purpose, what you're striving for, is eudaimonia. But that could be an abstract term. So give me a concrete, what does it mean? And I didn't know you were going to ask this question, Blair, but I showed two images, one of just the Lyceum with the picture of the trees and the walking paths and the building behind it. And then the second one was Carrie Ann and I in front of an Aristotle statue. The feeling was like nothing we'd had before. Like, first of all, we're in the presence of greatness. But then we smell, it's about 95 degrees, which the two of us actually like. So that was not a problem. I can understand. It's August in Greece. So 95 degrees is what you get. Mm-hmm. But the clay of the ground kind of clinging to our sandals, it's like, this is where he walked. Mm. And the buzzing cicadas that we hear in the trees, he heard these things. And the hills, the slight hills up and down that he would guide his students as walking here and there. She and I are holding hands and we both have goosebumps like, this man did this in this place 2,500 years ago. Our hearts are raised and we know it and we appreciate it. So in a sense, it's an act of justice to what he did, even if nobody else, frankly, we enjoyed that nobody else was there to,
sure,
to disturb our height. What does Ayn Rand call it? Like the highest high, yeah, that one can moment. Have, you know, and Blair and Martin, that's what we felt. That was exactly what we felt while we were there, and we went back. We said, we have to come back. We have, sure, to come back. So within the week's time we were in Athens, we went back three times to the Lyceum. And so all of these natural elements still remained from his day, but then conceptualizing what went on here and just trying to put ourselves back in that era. And what would we do, you know, if we're standing behind this master of the ages, and what, you know, what would we ask him? You know, that's like what went through our mind. And again, it was, this is eudaimonia. We as humans strive for this, but every once in a while, you know how Howard Roark says there are breaks. You keep going and going, but every once in a while you'll stop. And this is a point, an, yeah, unforgettable point. He mentions like Dominique or when he builds the Enright house. And so for us, it was, and I have to admit, we were early in the relationship. We were only like 6 months into the relationship together, but it's something the two of us had thought of for decades. And to be there together with a top value in front of a giant of the ages, absolutely incredible. And this is what eudaimonia feels like, if you ask me.
We've been talking to Robert Begley today on the Secular Foxhole. Robert, it's always a pleasure to have you. Thanks for manning the foxhole with us today.
Thank you. I think we escaped alive again, right?
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Live another day.
Yeah. Many, many more to come. Thank you, gentlemen, both. It's really been a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
All right, Robert. Thank you.